The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. We've got a lot of news to cover as usual. Coming up in the second half, we'll talk about an article titled Germany Must Abandon Its Military Reluctance and Lead from Spiegel magazine. And we'll also talk about a familiar face who, according to at least one betting agency, is the person third most likely to be Chancellor of Germany after the elections. That's coming up. But first, I want to talk about the terrorist attacks that we've seen in Europe this week. Last night, a rock concert was cancelled in Rotterdam after it looked like terrorists were about to strike there. There was a Spanish-registered van full of gas bottles. I don't think too much is known at this stage. Maybe we just dodged another attack. Maybe it was just a van in the wrong place at the wrong time. But it certainly shows that Europe lives in fear of terrorism, and it's not something that is going to go away anytime soon. But here's a, remarkable would be one way of describing it, story from The Telegraph last week in the wake of the attacks that we saw in Spain. Cat photos have been posted online in solidarity with Barcelona following the attack in which 13 people were killed and more than 100 injured. I think that death toll is slightly higher now. But it goes on to write, Twitter users are sharing the feline images instead of using graphic photos taken in the aftermath of the Los Ramblas rampage and a second attack in the coastal resort of Cambrils. The cute images began spreading online after Spanish police warned social media users not to share photos of victims, while others are sharing them to confuse suspects about ongoing police operations. So that's the response to these terrorist attacks by many in Europe. There's a big terrorist attack. Don't look at the shock and the horror on display. Don't look at the pictures of what's happened. Here, cat photos. Now, to be fair, I've got some sympathy for those spreading them to make sure that the suspects, or to try and help it so the suspects can't use social media to go and search through pictures and find out what police are doing. Not sure how useful it would be, but at least there's some sympathy for the motive there. But how's that for a symbol of Europe not wanting to face up to the reality of what is going on here? You've got, let's not have to force ourselves to come face to face to what's happening. Here are cat pictures instead. And remember, last time you had terrorists attacking Spain, the terrorist won. Spain ended up pulling out of Afghanistan. They basically gave in to the terrorists' demands. You know, now terrorism is back and people are responding with cat photos. Does that sound like a robust response to the terrorist threat? Is that going to prevent more attacks? Well, it's not. And so more attacks are coming. A few years ago, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry had an article called Why We Cannot Win the War Against Terrorism. And in that he wrote, the only way to win such a war is to deal with the main source of the terrorism or cut off the head of the terrorist snake. But neither the US nor Israel has the will to tackle Iran, even though it is the key part of the axis of evil in the Middle East. He talked about how our peoples lack the will to win this war against terrorism. Says the fruits and the evidence of the past two decades overwhelmingly prove where the king of state-sponsored terrorism is. The whole world can see that. However, the solution to terrorism lies in doing something about it. We must confront the source. The terrorist movement flows from Iran. And at the moment, you don't see people, or many people in Europe, doing something about it. The Spanish Prime Minister talked about how terrorism is Europe's greatest threat. But any kind of solutions have been notably absent. The key to solving this is doing something about it. And is Europe doing something? Is Europe doing anything? Well, until they do, we're just going to keep seeing these attacks. Geopolitical Futures had an excellent article on this subject this week called Where Europe and the Middle East Meet. I think it was by Jacob Shapiro. And they write that there are even larger forces at play. Spain does not belong to Europe, at least in the opinion of the Islamic State. Spain is a Muslim land. The Moors ruled this area, known to them as Al-Andalus, intermittently from the 8th century to the 15th century, when they were driven out entirely. The Islamic State sees Spain as a place to be reclaimed, and it makes sense for the Islamic State to reclaim it, at least from its leaders' point of view. Islam is the only force in the Arab world that has ever united its tribes under a single banner. With the Islamic State's caliphate shrinking, surrounded as it is on all sides by enemies in the Middle East, it needs to inspire its rank and file. Successful attacks, especially in lands it used to control, fit the bill perfectly. Then he goes on to write, "This illustrates the troubled relations between Europe and the Middle East. These two regions have always been connected to each other, and what happens in one affects the other. Instability and violence in the Middle East has led to Muslim migration to Europe. Muslim migration has in turn stoked nationalism, sometimes to electoral effect, and has even led to limited European involvement in Muslim wars. This reinforces the belief that Muslim immigrants can't be accepted by their new countries and wouldn't want to even if they could." So already, as he points out, their terrorist attacks in Europe are changing Europe. They're leading to more nationalism. They're reviving Europe's sense of pride in itself or in their own nations. They're leading to European involvement, although limited, European involvement in Muslim wars. This article concludes, "This is what makes the attacks in Spain so notable. Terrorism in Western Europe has been steadily increasing since about 2005. Nationalism has been rising in Europe since about the same time. The age-old conflict between Europe and the Middle East, Christendom and Islam, is simmering once more. What happened in Spain last week intersects all three." So it's simmering once more. Don't be fooled by the cat pictures. There are certainly those that do take that aren't, you know, that have quite this kind of very trite response. But there are tensions there. There are people in Europe, and that Europe is in a lot of ways responding to this clash. You can see this view building in a few places, and one place you can see it building is within certain members of the Catholic Church. You had almost this time last year, it was September 11th, on the 333rd anniversary of the Battle of Vienna, where Christian nations united to prevent the Muslim Ottoman Empire from conquering Vienna. The Archbishop of Vienna, Christopher Schönborn, he talked about an Islamic conquest of Europe. He said, "Will there now be a third attempt at an Islamic conquest of Europe? Many Muslims want that and say Europe is at its end." He said, he prayed, God have mercy on Europe and on your people who are in danger of forfeiting our Christian heritage. And of course, for that, you have to read Catholic Heritage. So he's talking about this not in terms of just radical Islam attacking Europe, but in terms of clashes between Islam as a whole. And not against Europe, but against Christianity and Europe's Christian heritage. That's the kind of thinking you're seeing more and more in certain parts of Europe in response to these attacks. And Schönborn, he's a former pupil of a former Pope, Pope Benedict XVI. And he's also still in the good books of Pope Francis. We had, was either in one of the last trumpets or in a soon coming one, an article by Andrew Miller on why Christopher Schönborn is a man to watch. Then more recently, you had Luc Revel. He was made Archbishop of Strasbourg by Pope Francis back in February. But just over a month ago, he gave a speech where he said, "Muslim believers know very well that their birth rate is such that today they call it the Great Replacement. And they tell you in a very calm, very positive way that one day, all this, it will be ours." So this phrase, "Great Replacement," comes from an influential French thinker, especially influential on kind of Europe's fringe politics with people like the National Front. But you've got a archbishop in the Catholic Church saying, well, unless we make some changes, Europe is going to be a Muslim continent. We need to make these changes. We need to do something about that. And there's more and more people drawing attention to some of this demography. The Gatestone Institute had an article a few days ago. It was talking about a report by the Italian think tank Centrilo Machiavelli. And this showed that if current trends continued by 2065, first and second generation migrants will be more than 40% of Italy's total population, or 40% of Italy's total population. So almost mostly migrants. In Germany, they write 36% of children under the age of 5 are being born to immigrant parents. So you're having a strong increase in people of a migrant background. Arot Sheva had an article where they quoted some figures from Austria's Office of Statistics, showing that by 2030, 40% of the population of Vienna will be foreign-born. They write that Muslim students, according to recent statistics, already outnumber Roman Catholic students at middle and secondary schools in Vienna. 2 years ago, before the wave of migrants, a study by the Vienna-based Wirral Project, this is still from quoting from a Arot Sheva, explained that in only 30 years' time, one-third of the capital will be Catholic and the proportion of Muslims will double to 21%. Austria's newspaper Kronenzeitung in last April, they wrote, in less than 30 years, Muslims could become the largest religious group in Vienna. And that comes from the Vienna Institute of Demography. So this is something that more and more people in Europe are talking about. And in Central and Eastern Europe, things have changed quite dramatically over the last few years already. They've made some major changes in how they deal with Islam. I think it's one of those things I could probably have written and talked more about on the trumpet, but it's something that it's kind of come across gradually, and by now the rhetoric in some ways doesn't sound unusual because we're used to it. But they've gone through a huge shift over the past few years. You've already got a whole host of nations in these countries effectively with a Christian-only migration policy and talking about Christian migrants only. They talk openly about Muslims not being welcome in their countries. And when they first started talking like that a few years ago, as I said, that was big news. It was against the European Union's rules. It was against their human rights laws. But nothing has happened. And now that's basically the new normal. You've got the Czech Republic, Hungary and Poland. They're all refusing to take part in Europe's redistribution of migrants from the Middle East. I think the Czech Republic is meant to have taken in nearly 3,000 migrants. They've taken in 12. Hungary was meant to take in 1,300. Sorry, they've taken in about zero. It was either Poland's foreign minister or prime minister. I neglected to write down who exactly said it, but they said it needs to be said clearly and directly. This is an attack on Europe, on our culture, on our traditions. Do we want strong politicians who can see the danger and fight against it effectively? So they see migration as an attack on their culture and their traditions. Slovakia, their prime minister, he said that migration from Muslim countries would change the essence of his country. He says, I do not want to see a Muslim community in Slovakia. That's a clash of civilizations building before our eyes. A clash between those that want to keep Europe Christian and between these Muslims. I do not want to see a Muslim community in Slovakia. I do not want there to be several tens of thousands of Muslims who gradually begin to promote their ideology. We do not want to change the traditions of this country, which are built on the Christian tradition. It has been like this for centuries. Sovereignty and national pride must be part of our ruling coalition. Hungary's Viktor Orban has been one of the most outspoken on this as well. Here's a quote from him. He said, let's not forget that these arriving has been raised in another religion. They represent a radically different culture. Most of them are not Christians, but Muslims. This is an important question because Europe and European identity is rooted in Christianity. It is not worrying in itself that European Christianity is now barely able to keep European Christian or Europe Christian. If we lose sight of this, the idea of Europe could become a minority interest in its own continent. A few months ago, Viktor Orban, he gave a speech in English to the European People's Party, the kind of the grouping in the European Parliament that he sits in. And we'll listen to a few clips from him and from that speech now.
Since our last Congress in Madrid, it has become evident that the language of liberal political correctness is even unable to identify and to understand the true dangers of migration. We Central Europeans expect that if things go on like this, there will be a dominant Muslim presence in the western half of Europe, even in the lifetime of our generation. I understand that the left is putting us under ideological pressure for the West to feel guilty for the Crusades and colonialism, but this leftist policy is intellectually disarming Europe against the invasion of the Muslim migration. We Central Europeans want to completely reform our migration policy. Borders must be taken under full control. The left has a clear action plan to transform Europe. They want to let millions of Muslims in. They want to put aside subsidiarity. They want to force bureaucratic rules on our labor market. They want to raise taxes. And ultimately, socialists want to build socialism in Europe. This would be fatal for Europe. We would lose our Christian identity, lose our competitiveness, and lose the hope of full employment. I suggest we accept the intellectual and political fight with the left. We are the People's Party, the Partido Popular, the Volkspartei. We should not be afraid of leftist criticism calling us populist. We know we are not. The EPP, the EPP should be the advocate and flagship of a Europe where there is a room for our Christian identity, our national pride. There is a room for our traditional family values and our workfare societies. If we want Europe to remain the greatest place in the world, then the European Union has to change. And in order to lead the way, we must start changing ourselves, the European People's Party. I am sure today we have taken a step to the right direction. Thank you very much.
So there you go. You heard him talking about Christian identity, about securing Europe's Christian identity against Muslims. On another speech, he said, "I think we have a right to decide that we do not want a large number of Muslim people in our country. We do not like the consequences of having a large Muslim community that we see in other countries. I do not see any reason for anyone else to force us to create ways of living together in Hungary that we do not want to see." And in this, there again, supported by not necessarily the Pope, but a lot of Catholic officials within and Christian leaders within that area. So the Archbishop Stanislav Wolonski, he talked about how adherents of Islam would fundamentally change our civilization. He's the president of the Slovak Bishops Conference. He said the larger the Muslim community, the likelier the violence. In such a situation, it's legitimate to ask about the religion these people profess and how beneficial it is to our society. We shouldn't forget that Christianity and Islam are, despite all efforts at dialogue, in permanent conflict. That's how the leader of the Slovak Bishops Conference sees things. Islam and Christianity are in permanent conflict. One side gains the upper hand. There's always conflict. Here's a quick quote from the National Catholic Reporter. They wrote that Romania's Bishops Conference has said little about the refugees. Bishops in Slovakia endorsed a government decision in August 2015 to bar Muslims who might not feel at home in a predominantly Catholic country. In the Czech Republic, where human rights groups criticise police for stamping numbers on refugees' hands, the Bishops' Conference previous president, Archbishop Jan Grubner, has demanded his country take only Christian refugees. So just about all of Eastern Europe and Central Europe has a very different view of Islam and what's happening with migration than the West does. They're much more alert to the dangers of terrorism that you saw in Spain. And there are a lot in the West that support people like Viktor Orban and what he says about Christian identity. Not the European Union officials as they are now, not necessarily the top leaders, but you certainly see a lot of the populist groups of people like the National Front. You also see the Christian Social Union in Germany, a right-wing mainstream party that's keen to that. I think it was over the winter they invited Viktor Orban in to speak. So this is still, you know, these kind of views are growing in Europe. And in a lot of ways, they're right. And there's a lot to sympathize with what they're saying, with the warnings they're giving about the dangers that Islam poses to Europe. But there's also a danger with these views as well, and that's one we'll get to soon. But also, as we see these same views emerging and becoming just very common in Eastern and Central Europe, Europe is also getting much more involved within the Muslim world. And just over the summer, there's been a steady increase of European involvement in North Africa. Germany and France, they're backing the creation of a new military force in Africa. It's going to be made up of troops from Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger. It will be a 5,000-strong European-trained equipped force called G5 Sahel. And it's meant to be fully operational by September. These two countries in particular are doing a lot of fighting in North Africa and in that what's called the Sahel region, North and West Africa. And by forming this joint force that can cross these borders, they're hoping to be able to pass some of that fighting off to basically local African clients. An internal document from the European Action Service that was leaked by Spiegel on August 17th showed that Germany and France were not only planning to provide training and infrastructure to the G5 Sahel force, which is what they've been talking about, but they were getting ready to provide weapons, ammunition, military vehicles. So they're going to be training and arming this new force in Africa. And also over the summer, you've seen terrorist attacks and violence and instability drawing Europe deeper into the area. There were 18 people killed, 20 injured in a shooting outside a restaurant in Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso on August 13th. The next day, you had terrorists killing 7 in an attack on the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stability Mission in Mali. And that's the deadliest UN mission in the world because of these kind of attacks. And then meanwhile, in this Central African Republic, the United Nations aid chief, Stephen O'Brien, he warned on August 7th that the early warning signs of genocide are there. And the violence is spiraling out of control in the Central African Republic. So all of those are drawing Germany and France, who are already fairly deeply involved into the area, in those areas, much more deeply in. At the same time, you see Italy getting drawn more closely in. On August 7th, Italy's parliament voted to dispatch its navy to the coast of Libya. Now, in the past, Italy's patrolled outside of Libyan waters, and under their interpretation of international human rights laws, if they're outside Libyan waters, they've got to take the migrants back to Italy. But if they are allowed into Libyan waters, well, then they can drop those guys off within Libya. They don't need to take them back to Italy. And so that's a big incentive for them. So they're getting involved in Libyan waters. Them and France are looking to get more involved with some of the Libyan militia and working with them in terms of trying to have bases on Libyan soil to stop migrants. So you see Europe being drawn in more and more over the last few months into conflict with terrorist groups and with Muslim groups within North Africa. Back in April 25th, 2013, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote, "Northern Africa is turning into a battleground with enormously important prophetic implications." He talked about the spread of Iranian-backed terrorist groups, and he also wrote that Iran isn't the only one interested in Africa. Germany is making strong inroads as well. Both these powers are racing to get as much control of North Africa as they can. They will inevitably clash with each other. And that's what we're seeing right now. That's why you have articles by Geopolitical Futures talking about, writing, the age-old conflict between Europe and the Middle East, Christendom and Islam is simmering once more. That's what we see right now. But where is this leading? At the Trumpet, we've been writing about this common clash for a long time. We've been writing about it well before 2005, even, and that uptick in terrorist attacks in Europe that Geopolitical Futures mentioned. Why have we been writing about this? Well, we've been writing about it because of events forecast in the Bible. Daniel chapter 11 talks a lot about events in the Middle East, and it starts by talking about ancient events. It forecasts leaders like Alexander the Great, and the prophecies in there are so clear and so accurate that those that would dismiss the Bible, those that don't believe in the Bible, basically say that this part of Daniel is just a big forgery. They say that somebody wrote these parts of the, or at least these parts of the book of Daniel, after the events that they describe, and then somehow pretended that they were written before and that they were prophecy. Because that's the only way that they can explain just how accurate what is in Daniel 11 is. Now, Daniel 11 verses 2 and 3, for example, talk about a king of Greece, a mighty king, it says, who'll stand up and rule with great dominion. A king of Greece that will conquer Persia. You can see that from verse 2. And then verse 4 says that this great Greek king that conquers Persia dies at the height of his power, and that the kingdom isn't passed on to his children, but instead is split four ways. You know, and that is undeniably exactly what happened to Alexander the Great. And the only thing that critics of the Bible can say about that to deny the Bible's authority is to say that this was written long after Alexander the Great and is a forgery and is just pretends to be prophesying it in advance. Now, actually, there is a lot of solid historical evidence that the book of Daniel was written when it says it was written. Maybe that's a subject for another program, another day. But if you believe the Bible, you have very solid, concrete evidence of fulfilled prophecy right here. And the rest of Daniel 11, it just goes on to talk about in great detail and in ways that are easily put together with a history book, events of the Middle East over the next few centuries after Alexander the Great. But in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40, it jumps forward in time in terms of what it's talking about. It says, and at the time of the end. At the time of the end. So now it's not talking about events in the ancient Middle East. Now it's talking about material for us. And if we can trust what the Bible, if what it said about Alexander the Great, if that turned out to be correct and true, well, then we can trust what it's saying here for us as well. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come at him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and overflow and pass over. Well, who is this? Who are these people that this verse is talking about? Who is the king of the south? Who is the king of the north? What is the message it's getting here? Well, we'll look at the king of the north first. And if you look at the historical part of this prophecy, you can see that partway through, the king of the north begins to refer to a king ruling in Syria. And Herbert W. Armstrong, explaining this chapter, he wrote in 65 BC, Syria was swallowed up by the Roman Empire and became a Roman province. The Roman Empire now controlled Judea, and therefore the king of the north here referred to is at the time the emperor of the Roman Empire. So at that point in time, I think that was somewhere around verse 36, when it's talking about the king of the north, it's referring to the emperor of the Roman Empire. And Mr. Fleury wrote in our free booklet, The King of the South, this is a critical piece of the puzzle. But if the king of the north referred to the Roman Empire after that point, well, what about now? And the Roman Empire fell, quite obviously, a long time ago. So who does the king of the north refer to now? Well, people kept on trying to resurrect the Roman Empire. You know, it was revived under Emperor Justinian. Charlemagne was crowned king of the Emperor of the Roman Empire. He was crowned Caesar Augustus. after the first Augustus Caesar. Then you had the Holy Roman Empire under Otto. You had the Holy Roman Empire under the Habsburgs. Napoleon, once he replaced the Holy Roman Empire, he said, "Well, I am a Roman Caesar." And he modeled so much of what he did after Rome and after Charlemagne. So people kept resurrecting, bringing back the Roman Empire. There have been six resurrections of this kind of religious Holy Roman Empire, working with the church. And we're witnessing the seventh. Otto von Habsburg, the successor of the Habsburg Empire, he famously said, "The European community is living largely by the heritage of the Holy Roman Empire, though the great majority of the people who live by it don't know by what heritage they live." Europe is the modern incarnation of that Roman Empire. And so when it's talking about the King of the North, it's talking about Europe. And it's talking about a German-led Europe. That's something we'll look at a bit more detail in the second half, if we have time for the second half at this rate. So Europe is the King of the North. And that makes perfect sense. They're the major power north of the Middle East. You can see further on that tidings out of the East and out of the North trouble the King of the North. So the King of the North can't be Russia. Or it can't be China, these nations that are north or east, they're talked about separately. So Europe is the King of the North. Well, then who is the King of the South? Well, we can quite quickly eliminate a few powers. We can know that it's not Egypt, Libya, or Ethiopia. They're mentioned separately in verses 42 and 43. So they're not the King of the North, the King of the South, because they're mentioned as separate powers to the King of the South. So it's a dominant power, though, within the Middle East. Well, who could it be? Well, what about Saudi Arabia or Turkey? They're quite powerful nations within the Middle East. Could it be one of them? Well, there is another nation that's a better candidate. But also these military powers are described in Psalm 83 as being allied with Germany, being allies with the King of the North. So it can't be Turkey and it can't be Saudi Arabia. They're not pushing at the King of the North. They're not fighting with the King of the North. They're described elsewhere as being allied with the King of the North. That leaves, when you're looking at major powers in the Middle East, and you've eliminated all of those, that leaves Iran and Iranian-backed radical Islam. And they match this description of pushy foreign policy. You've had headlines recently, I think it was one in the New York Times. Can anyone stop Iran from taking over Iraq? Iran is dominating the Middle East. They match perfectly. We'll hear just a quick clip of Mr. Flurry talking about this on a Key of David program several years ago.
Warren Christopher said in 1994 that the world's most significant state sponsor of terrorism is Iran. See, we know and we can see that. And we can see why they're king, that Iran is king, because they are just terrorizing much of the world. And yet nobody has the courage to stand up to them, at least yet, not to this point. Nobody will stand up to them, and anybody that knows anything about foreign policy ought to realize that when you commit acts of terrorism against other nations, that those are acts of war. But somehow, Iran always gets away with it so far. But that's about to change. That is about to change. Here, this nation, this King of the South, is close to Jerusalem, Egypt, Ethiopia, and Libya. So who else could it be in this end time, in that area, but Iran? Who else could it be? Now, we can prove this very easily, but you know that is the only really pushy nation there in the Middle East. Syria supports them in many ways and is somewhat like a puppet, but it's Iran that pulls all the strings. And where is it leading? Where is it leading? I mean, these are events that are being fulfilled right now, and where is it all leading? I'll tell you, it's leading to World War III. That's what your Bible says. Can you believe your Bible? Well, that certainly is what it says. Here you have a nation willing to commit terrorist acts, and they've been doing that for many years. And to have a peace pact and to establish peace is contrary to their nature. That doesn't fit into their goals at all. Do you realize that terrorism in the Middle East originated with Iran? It originated with them, and they've been doing it ever since because, well, it's been so productive for them. It's really paid off for them. And nobody seems to want to take them on and tell them that, well, look, that's an act of war, and we're going to deal with it accordingly.
So Iran fits that description of the King of the South perfectly. And so you have this description here of the King of the South in Daniel 11 and verse 40 pushing at Europe. Of Iran pushing at Europe. That's something we've been forecasting for years, that radical Islam supported by Iran would be pushing at Europe. And now you have geopolitical futures writing the age-old conflict between Europe and the Middle East, Christendom and Islam, is simmering once more. Mr. Flurry was writing about this all the way back in 1992, in kind of the very early days of the Trumpet magazine. He said, it looks very much like the end-time King of the South will rule the radical Islamists. Iran is a natural leader for many today, of them today. Iran also has a goal to lead this group. So all the way back in the early 90s, and you can see it now building in Europe before your eyes. We'll listen to one more quick clip from a Key of David program on this coming clash.
So here's the King of the North, a German-led Europe that is going to clash with the King of the South. That's Iran and radical Islam. And the King of the North, or the European power, is going to triumph in this war. But that is not going to happen before the King of the South, or Iran and radical Islam, do a lot of damage to the Middle East and have a lot to do with skyrocketing oil prices and really shaking and perhaps even wrecking economies in the Western world. They are going to push and push. That's what they are said to do here. They just have a foreign policy of push and push and push. And as you know, Iran is the number one terrorist sponsoring nation in the world. I'm sure most of you already know that. But this King of the North is going to come against Iran like a whirlwind, probably with nuclear bombs, and they're going to destroy Iran. And then at that time, they're going to subdue all of the nations that were allied with Iran. And that's where Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia come in.
So that's where this is leading. That's where these terrorist attacks are leading. You see Iran trying to gain more and more power than radical Islam. It already backs so many of these terrorist groups. And you see Europe now building to a response. You already see Iran having a very pushy foreign policy. I mean, who's the nation that has the rogue nuclear program? Look how accurate Daniel 11 has proven in the past. And then look how accurate even already it is in describing what helping us understand the news that we see today. It's an excellent guide for understanding what is happening in the Middle East. But then Daniel 11 and verse 45 also talks about the end of this King of the North, the end of this European power that comes down into the Middle East with such great destruction. It says, and he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain in Israel. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. The next chapter goes on to talk. This talking about the end of this power that's so destructive. And the next chapter goes on to give us a lot of hope and a lot of positivity. Daniel chapter 12 and verse 2 says, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. And they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. in concluding the King of the South booklet, towards the end of that booklet, Mr. Flowery writes, in the midst of clashing empires, God emphasizes the mind-dazzling potential of mankind. They don't see that potential yet, but a small remnant do. They are preparing now to teach the whole world, billions of people. Our message is vibrating with transcendental hope. So Daniel chapter 11, Daniel chapter 12, it contains a sobering vision. It contains one that has already been proven true in its forecasting of events. It has a, you know, a sobering picture of the future, one of a king of the north, of a Europe attacking Iran like a whirlwind. It talks about a lot of destruction there. There's some parts of that that aren't necessarily pleasant subjects. But right in there, in the midst of that, God emphasizes, as Mr. Flowery brought out, that mind-dazzling potential of mankind. All of this is part of his plan, one far greater than most know today. In the midst of all this, he talks about human beings shining as the stars forever and ever. The start of Daniel chapter 11 has proven true. The end of Daniel chapter 11, you can see that unfolding in your news screens every day. And this part of this prophecy in Daniel chapter 12, following straight on from that, talking about human beings shining as the stars forever and ever, this part of the prophecy is every bit as sure. To learn more about this, to learn what this is talking about here, about that potential, about the King of the North and the King of the South, about where this is leading, you can go on our website, read our free book, The King of the South. We ship it anywhere in the world for free. You can read it online as well. Download the PDF. I think we have all kinds of e-reader formats. It's in the iBook store. There's lots of ways you can get a hold of it. But the easiest, if you go to our website, thetrumpet.com, click on the literature request tab, and we want to give you this information for free, and we're more than happy to do that. So be sure you go there. We'll take a quick break now, and when we get back, we'll talk about some of those German news stories that I promised you.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Germany must abandon its military reluctance and lead. This is the title of an article published today by Spiegel, by American journalist Anne Applebaum. She's also the wife of the former Polish foreign minister, Radoslaw Sikorski. And she begins this by writing, Germany enjoys high regard around the world. But with American power weakening and authoritarian powers rising, the country needs to abandon its military reluctance and finally lead Europe. She begins by talking about her experience in Germany with the Berlin Wall coming down. She's talked about how, you know, she still sees that positive Germany that she saw that night, but she writes, the question is now whether that Germany can survive. And she talks about the unstable world that it's facing, about how America is stepping back from the world and is just really exhorting Germany to take care of itself. She writes that at the very least, Germany by itself lacks the military power and therefore the foreign policy clout to keep Europe safe from future Russian aggression, to help bring peace and thus to end the refugee crisis to the Middle East, to do anything about the reconstruction of Libya except talk about it. She talks about how Germany's not doing enough militarily. She said, I can understand the historical reasons for Germany's reluctance to think about confrontation, and I respect them. But she said, that is no excuse for naivety. If Germany does not want a powerful army, it should still, as a matter of urgency, work with the institutions it has built, most notably the European Union, especially with France and even Britain, to create a multinational European force that can be deployed in Europe's borders and in Europe's name at any time. It should be part of NATO and should work with NATO. But the era of total dependency on the US military is over. So she's encouraging them to form a European army. But note how she ends this. She said, but while it's true that the best response will be European responses, it is also true that they require Germany, Europe's richest country and its most admired country, to lead them. So Germany needs Europe to lead them. Or at least co-lead them, she writes. And this, I know, will require an effort of imagination on the parts of many Germans, but now is not the moment to be complacent. So she's saying Europe needs Germany to lead them. Yet another example of someone from America, someone who's quite influential, saying to Germany, go and lead Europe. Europe needs you to become a military power. It needs you to take charge. And Germany has a lot of potential to do this. But what it really needs is just is the right leadership. And where could this come from? Well, I want to transition to another remarkable news story, recent news story, and it's from the Telegraph, called What Happens If Angela Merkel Loses the German Elections? And in this article, they talk about alternative leaders. And listen to this. At Paddy Power, that's a pretty common betting or bookies agency, a betting website, betting shop where you can go and bet on sports events or even politics, as this talks about. So at Paddy Power, she's 1-14 on to hold power, where her next main rival, the Social Democratic leader Martin Schulz, is a 7-1 shot. And the next closest contender, so who's in third place? Who do they have as the third closest contender to be Chancellor of Germany? The next closest contender, the splendidly named Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, the former defense minister who could lead the center-right CDU-CSU if Merkel stumbled, is on 50-1. You can get better odds on Wayne Rooney being the top scorer on the premiership season, but that doesn't seem terribly likely either. So 50-1, they're not saying it's necessarily hugely possible or hugely probable, but I think it's still fascinating. Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg is the third most likely to lead. We'll talk about who he is in just a second. I'll just read a few more quotes from this article. And they said, and yet the one thing we have surely learned in the past years is to never take any election for granted. When the experts say something is a done deal, it often pays to take the other side of the trade. There are signs that an upset could be on the cards. It is still a volatile mix, they write. The left party could collapse, creating a surge for the SDP. The AfD could eat into Merkel's support. So could the Free Democrats, with proportional representation in so many parties in the mix. There is plenty to play for. The impact of Merkel losing would be huge and very unpredictable. And it goes on to talk about how a Merkel loss could make Germany very unstable, German politics very unstable. They talked about how it could, or he talks about how it could lead to an outbreak of the Euro crisis, as investors worry about the security of their southern European debt holdings without Germany at the helm. He concludes that, but the past 12 months have shown no vote can be taken for granted. And even this one is not an exception. The markets often witness a September shock. And if one arrives this year, it is most likely to be an electoral upset in Germany. And the possibilities of a Merkel loss are certainly very intriguing to think about. And there's that the number three contender on the Paddy Power list, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. And that really is remarkable, considering he's not in office. This is a man that's not in office. He has no elected position in Germany. He's not campaigning for an elected office or for election in any way. And they're saying, well, if there's some kind of upset, if Angela Merkel doesn't win, Martin Schulz from the Social Democrats doesn't get in, and Merkel, you know, is forced out as leader of the Christian Union parties, well, the next most likely person to lead in that kind of scenario is Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. He's the politician on the right that we see as the top alternative to Angela Merkel if she doesn't get the job. Here's what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote about Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg back in 2010. An impressive man appeared in the front lines of German politics when he was appointed as Germany's Minister of Economics just February last year. Then, right after Germany's election, Angela Merkel rocketed his political stature overnight by giving him the senior portfolio of defense minister. His name is Baron Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. This young aristocratic Guttenberg is particularly interesting because of his family and political connections. His early development in life was guided by Edmund Stoiber. He was appointed General Secretary of the Bavarian Christian Social Union, Stoiber's political party. Stoiber's political mentor, he writes, was the Bavarian Prime Minister whom he succeeded, Franz Josef Strauss, who was known at the time as the strong man of Europe. Mr. Flurry also writes, Guttenberg is also connected through part of his family line to the House of Habsburg. Strauss and Otto von Habsburg shared a common dream of a united Catholic Europe. And so Mr. Flurry, he wrote at the time and focused a fair bit on zu Guttenberg, and we'll talk about some of the more prophetic reasons why in a minute. But then in 2011, he was fired. There was a big plagiarism scandal, and well, that's it. He's finished. It looked like he was finished, political career over. And it looked to a lot of people like we were mistaken in talking about Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. Yet just, you know, even just within weeks or days after that firing, we wrote in the Trumpet, so it is yet again at risk of being repetitive. We say, watch Germany, and as you do, watch for the return of Guttenberg in the near future to front stage and center in German politics. It looked like he was down and out then. We said, watch for his return. And now you've got him, the bookies listing him as third most likely to end up as German Chancellor. Now, in just a few days, he's going to take on his most prominent role yet in this kind of revived political career. He'll be representing the Christian Social Union Party on the national stage, on TV, and at major campaign events. But what are we watching for in zu Guttenberg? Why talk about zu Guttenberg? Well, it's also from the book of Daniel. And Daniel chapter 8. And again, Daniel chapter 8 makes clear, just like that part of Daniel chapter 11, that it's for the end time. Verse 17 talks of Daniel chapter 8 talks about, at the end time shall be the vision. You see this, we'll read verse 23, and in the latter time of their kingdom. So it's talking about some prophecies for Daniel's day, but then at the latter time, at the end, when the transgressions are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, and he shall destroy wonderfully or mightily and shall prosper and practice. And it goes on to talk more about that. And Mr. Flurry, he wrote about this. He drew attention to the fact that God calls this leader a king. He wrote that Daniel 11 and verse 21 prophesies that the same leader and that he shall come into power by flatteries, probably not by votes, but through a coalition government of some kind. That's a direct quote from Mr. Flurry. We don't have time to go into the background of that, but I will give you a booklet at the end that you can look at to learn more about that. But come in by flatteries, come in through perhaps some kind of coalition. And that's the exact scenario that the bookies are saying, well, if we have some kind of scenario where we don't have a leader and there's coalition negotiations, well, zu Guttenberg is one of the top contenders. Exactly the way that Mr. Flurry said, well, based on this Bible prophecy, watch for him to come into power. Mr. Fleury, he has a booklet called A Strong German Leader is Imminent. And he writes about how strong leaders are rising on the world scene today in several nations. He talks about how Europe doesn't have one, but he says there are several signs in world news that a strong leader is about to rise on the world scene. Also, a prophecy in Daniel 8 talks about a fiercely powerful king who is going to rise on the world scene in Europe and shock the world. It is one of the most astonishing prophecies in the Bible. A strong German leader is imminent. When he comes to power, the world will be shocked as he has never been before. And as we talked about, this German power, it lives by the heritage of the Holy Roman Empire. In that booklet, Mr. Fleury wrote that Mr. Strauss had a vision of the Holy Roman Empire. He passed that on to his protege, Edmund Stoiber, and Stoiber has mentored Baron Gutenberg to nurture the same vision. So that's in a nutshell, why we're watching Zu Gutenberg. There's a lot to say that he could be that king that is talked about in Daniel 8. And Mr. Fleury writes much more about that in that booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. But note what else he writes there. He writes, the wrong people have hijacked the powerful European Union. That empire is about to clash with Jesus Christ himself. You can see that in Daniel 8, verse 25, says that he shall stand up against the Prince of Princes. Mr. Fleury writes, take a good look at this Holy Roman Empire. It's going to be the last one you will see forever. That is the best news this world has ever heard, and you can prove it from your Bible. So again, some hard prophecies, but good news too. These same prophecies that are proven so right that you can now watch probably be fulfilled now in Zu Gutenberg over the next, I don't know how long it might take, days, weeks, months, years, perhaps. But you can see in those same prophecies, it talks about Jesus Christ being about to return. Mr. Fleury writes in this book, the last head of the Holy Roman Empire is going to fight Jesus Christ at his second coming. The world will see how unholy the Holy Roman Empire is. How can we not be moved and stirred intensely by this universe-shaking prophecy? What an exciting time to be alive, not because we understand the Holy Roman Empire, but because we understand the omnipotent God who revealed this prophecy to us. As we see these events unfolding, as you watch and see Daniel 8 unfolding, as it looks like we're seeing right now, you can know that there is a great omnipotent God working this out. To learn more, as I said, go and read that free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. You can read that on our website. That is about all I have time for. Mr. Fleury should be back tomorrow. So tune in then and keep on listening at kpcg.fm or at 101.3 on the FM dial.